Recording in Los Gatos, California on February 1st, 2016. This is GeekSpeak, episode 5 of our 16th season. You are listening to independent public radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxler, your host and producer of GeekSpeak, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie.
How you doing?
Hey, what's the difference between a software engineer and a programmer and a software developer?
Depends on who you ask.
What do you think of it?
Software engineer would be someone that has established processes, and that would include best practices for your code, having systems for checking for memory leaks, for example, for doing continuous integration, for looking to see what performance problems are there, active profiling as part of the workflow.
Okay. And what about a developer, like an application developer or a software developer? What's the difference there?
If you've learned how to program.
And what about a programmer?
If you've learned how to program. Developer.
So you basically say engineer is a good programmer. I mean.
Well, not necessarily, because I've met software engineers who weren't particularly good at slinging code, but they were exacting in their methods.
Okay. So is it kind of comparable to someone who's a structural engineer versus someone who's a construction person who builds buildings?
Sure, I'd go with that.
Okay. So there's more in the engineering field, there's more mathematics involved, but not necessarily as much code writing? Because I consider myself a software engineer. That's on my title and everything. But I'm not, you know, classically trained. I'm self-taught, as are you, correct?
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah. So someone recently said programmer, and I tried to explain this to them, and I realized, you know, I don't even know.
Well, that's also well. From computer scientists, which is what a lot of programmers, or at least what they hope to have, is a computer science degree. Because that is very much separate from programming.
Yes, I totally understand computer science is separate from programming.
Computer engineering also tends toward hardware as well, but that can also be toward that application of programming techniques and that systems.
So you can join the conversation here. Just email us. We're geeks at geekspeak.org. And of course, everything we talk about is up at geekspeak.org. Mile? We've talked about IP version 4 and how it's going away because we're running out of numbers, IP, Internet Protocol numbers, addresses, and we're moving to IPv6 slower than we assumed. I think we just recently passed the, was it 20-year union of IPv6?
yes.
Yeah. So, but you've got some news on that?
But we're also at something like 2% of traffic. I forget. We're at some...
Yeah, we're moving that direction.
Yeah, I'm moving that. One of the things about IPv6 that people have always trumped up in terms of enhancing our security is its resistance to network scanning. And network scanning would be you get on the internet and you start looking for IP addresses. There's a total of 4 billion and change, and fewer than that because many of them are allocated to private addresses. And so it's a search space that, you know, 4 billion, the computer can count to 4 billion in no time flat.
Sure.
So it can scan, and they do scan the internet at large.
And when you say scan, it's kind of like just going through. If we make the metaphor to phone numbers, which is pretty easy for us to talk about, you have an address in a phone book, you have an address in IPv table.
Yeah, back in the day, an auto dialer.
Yeah, an auto dialer that could just basically say, "I'm going to start it. You know, this area code and this prefix and 0000, and I'll just call everybody and tell people and find out who answers the phone. Say hi to them, and then
and skipping the numbers that begin with 1 because that's an area code designation. And,
right.
Yeah.
And so you could basically over time go through all of those. That's scanning. That's port scanning of phone numbers.
Well, network scanning.
Network scanning. In fact, that is what. Is being done in war games by the young boy who's trying to find modems.
Yeah, the auto dialer. Yeah,
he has an auto dialer going, just trying to find modems to answer the calls, and that's how he actually finds what is the giant computer in
The Whopper.
The Whopper. Yes, that's how he actually gets in touch with the Whopper, which of course is a game simulation program that happens to be running the control of the nuclear weapons.
Yeah, also known as Joshua. Games, yeah,
Joshua. Also. If you haven't seen War Games, you got to see War Games. It's a blast.
The the auto dialers, I mean, we look back at them and they seem kind of quaint because even when we were coming up and we had a 2400 baud modem, that was so much better and you'd be able to dial a lot faster than that. And you'd also be caught that much faster, but that's a whole other story. And computers have gotten so much faster now that dialing through the equivalent of 4 billion telephone numbers is
trivial.
Cakewalk. Yeah. IPv6 is so huge, 2 to the 128, which is a number that's so large that you just can't, like, every grain of sand gets
on all the planets in our solar system.
Yeah, gets many IP addresses.
Yeah, that's one of the things touted all the time. What does this have to do with port scanning?
Because with so many addresses, you can't look through that search space that quickly. You can't just dial every number and end any time before the heat death of the universe.
So port scanning, this idea on a phone...
Or network scanning.
Port scanning
a different thing.
Sorry. Network scanning, one of the things you can do in your home network, for example, is you can slowly just iterate over all the addresses in your home network or your cable provider. And there's actually not that many. It's actually a subnet, so it's even smaller than that. But you can step over all of these addresses. And when you get an address and the machine responds to a ping, you can actually talk to the machine, if you will, and ask it questions about what services it have available. That's the port scanning aspect. Mm-hmm. So the address scanning is the first step, which is quite easy to do in IPv4. But in IPv6, because there's so many millions and millions and millions of addresses.
Millions doesn't even cover it.
I know. Yeah. But on subnets, let's say, millions and millions and millions of addresses, it's so hard to do that. There, you can actually do that, which means from a privacy perspective, it seems to be better in that regard, right?
Yes. And that was one of the advantages that they were touting. There's a wrinkle to this, though. There is a search engine called Shodan. And Shodan is a search engine for vulnerabilities.
Oh, yes. I've heard of this. So when you hear of like a home router having a vulnerability, if you go do a search on, what is it, Shodan?
Mm-hmm.
You can actually look for that model and it will say all the IP addresses that have that model attached. And therefore, it's really easy to crack into them. Really not a great service. At the same time, if there's less security vulnerabilities, the service wouldn't be valuable anyway.
It's definitely in the dark gray area. Not quite. We were talking about black hats, white hats last week.
Yeah.
Now, when talking about it, you'd say, okay, but how would they find it with IPv6? It seems like that search engine would go the way of the dodo. But there's another service on the internet called NTP, Network Time Protocol.
Sure. This is how on your computer, if you have it set up correctly, how your computer just automatically changes and keeps the time correct. Mm-hmm. And during daylight savings, will just automatically change. It's connected to a service that provides time.
Right. And it used to be maintained by a single individual.
That's insane.
Yes. And there are a lot of things with the internet that used to be maintained by a single individual. DNS used to be a host file that was out.
domain name service. But so, what about the time with port scanning?
It started because it was had a single point of failure because it was not being maintained by a system in place. Yeah, for one particular company to host for everyone, there's no real money in that, so no one has an incentive to do it. There's something known as the NTP pool project, which is a cluster of volunteers that they donate server time to answer time queries. And there is one for IPv4, and there's a way to connect to it for IPv6 as well. Shodan, the folks who run that vulnerability search engine, added server resources to the pool project.
Oh, no.
Okay. Which means that every time...
So real clear, the pool project is a system in place where somebody can have, I have a server and I'm going to provide network time and I'm going to register myself to this pool of servers out there. And then basically everybody will partially get some of this traffic that people, machines are trying to update. Sometimes they'll hit that server, sometimes they'll hit another server. And of course, when they do that...
And desktop machines or things like that will hit very often, like multiple times a day.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Right. And why not? Why wouldn't you? Exactly. In fact, most machines are set up that way. Even our mobile devices are set up that way so that when you fly from one place to another, it'll actually update its
Most of the time, it's the telecoms.
Oh, really?
Okay.
So in any case, though, when you say, hey, time server, please tell me what time it is, you have to communicate, which means you have to give your IP address to that box.
Right.
And therefore, if their search engine finding IP addresses to scan IP addresses is offering that, they're actually collecting viable IP addresses, even in the IPv6 space.
Right. Exactly.
A little devious.
Yes.
How many IP addresses have they actually collected?
I don't know exactly the numbers. At the same time, well, let's put it this way. If you have an IPv6 device, and chances are if you have a so-called Internet of Things,
yes,
it's going to be using IPv6 because we're already running out of IPv4. And so any new devices, especially these little one service items mm-hmm. that's going out there, is going to want to get into the bigger pool
yeah.
of things, especially because you don't have to do a legacy connect with an Internet of Things.
Sure,
The new
Makes sense. As long as the local networks actually support IPv6, then the Internet of Things devices will definitely be IPv6, much simpler.
Right. So once you have, you know, your toothbrush or your Barbie dolls or your refrigerator or something like that, connecting up to get time from these time servers – and this especially happens with a lot of Linux systems
mm-hmm.
where they just go, hey, I'm just going to connect to
default
NTP pool.
Default install of Linux is normally a default points to the pool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then suddenly Shodan has – they don't have to do a network scan anymore. They wait for you to come to them.
I mean that of course is assuming that these Internet of Things things have public IP addresses. They don't necessarily have public IP addresses. Just because we're moving to IPv6 and we have infinite amount of IP addresses, it doesn't mean that all of them will actually be public, will they?
One of them one of the things about IPv6 is that you don't need network address translation, NAT.
Yeah.
And so firewalls take on a much bigger role. And
let's
you can have
– yeah, let me just describe NAT real quick. If you lived in an apartment building and there was one phone at the – or even a hotel. Hotel's a perfect example. This is like phone number NAT. You call the hotel and then you put in a four-digit code, which is the room number of the person you're reaching, and then their phone rings. So there's one step away from an actual public phone. Miles, when he stays at a hotel, has a phone number there, but it's not actually directly connected to the network. It has to go through the front switch desk.
Right. And the phone that I'm using in my room, I can call out to anyone, and if they had caller ID, they'd see the phone number of the hotel.
That's right. So that is network address translation. It's a way of making one public IP address many computers behind the scenes. All of our home networks use this way. Mm-hmm. And the reason is twofold. One's for the privacy aspect of it. You can't be port scanned on those devices that are behind the firewall. And the second is just because there wasn't enough IP addresses. But with IPv6, there is enough IP addresses. You don't technically need to do that anymore. But that doesn't alleviate the privacy, except that you can't really be scanned unless somebody knows your IP address. That's kind of the problem
right.
scope? All right.
And that comes into play with regard to firewalls.
Yeah.
With firewalls, you do want to block any access that comes in there, and any devices should have a block on there. But we found that commercial internet gateways, the cheap ones, don't always handle the security correctly.
Right. In fact, lots of times they have UUNP public on the front side. They've got all these problems, which of course you can search on Shodan and find out if people have problematic front doors.
Right. And especially if someone is connecting and they're routing through that router, then you can find the path that it took, and Shodan can check all the intermediate points between.
Will, is the pool of network time pool, is that community going to say, you know what, you can't do this kind of thing? Are they going to block down on this, or does it seem totally viable?
Well, how do you stop that?
You can make a policy against it.
Yes, you can. But for example, assuming that Shodan doesn't actually say, "Hey, we're the Shodan guys, and we're putting you a
yes.
server," how would you know what affiliation they had?
Okay, so the real trick would
be here.
How
would you know it wasn't a shell company that, and their logs
right.
were going someplace
you
didn't know about?
And the solution that I would do as a geek is run a network address. A time address system in my local router, and have all my devices point to that. That's one way to solve that problem. And then have that one router, and then I only have one public IP.
Yeah. Or go to a specifically known
Apple provide ones. Google's provides them. They're around.
Yeah.
All right. Any case, whole article about that and everything we talk about up at GeekSpeak.
Is everyone scared yet?
Miles, have you heard the term going dark with regards to security and the government?
Yes, I have.
Can you describe what that means? I've got a story about this.
This is editorializing here, a scare tactic that I've heard from,
what's your opinion?
From law enforcement. Yes. I preface it saying it's editorial, where right now with a court order and sometimes without a court order, you'll have wiretaps. So someone will be able to say, hey, this phone number seems to be a person of interest, mm-hmm. and we want to know who they're contacting. We're going to put a wiretap on that number and see.
A judge has to listen to the argument and make a case of, and make a judgment on whether the privacy or this public good is better served by doing this.
In theory, except for the whole NSA.
Secret courts and things of that nature.
Metadata, but
theoretically, that's how our Constitution is structured. And so thereby that – going dark is referring to
the increased use of encryption in communications. So things like FaceTime or Hangouts.
And the argument goes something like this. We are police officers and we used to be able to go to a judge and say, can we get a court order on this phone? And then we could tap basically the only communication means this house had of getting out in the world. Listen on the phone calls, find out when they're doing a bad thing and catch them in the act. And as soon as they started using Skype and encryption protocols and stuff, no longer could the police do the same thing they used to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to change the way they do it.
And at that point,
this
all they
arms
knew,
race kind of thing is continuing.
All they knew was the IP address from the source and then the destination. Then so, you put in a proxy server and suddenly you don't have the source
right.
very
so there's
easily.
This kind of continual process of getting deeper and deeper in the tech. And then companies like Apple come out and say, actually, we're going to make it even if you give us a court order, it's impossible for us to investigate who, what they're saying,
or
what they're doing.
What I had seen with Apple was that with iOS 7, they were saying it takes a huge amount of effort. It's really hard, and that's just for iOS 7. And the newer devices, it's not even worth talking about. So we want to head this off in the past and say it was bad enough. Then we can't respond to it now.
But more than that, not even about the difficulty on it, they've actually engineered their hardware so they cannot unlock it. That's the argument, at least, that they're making. So there's been a lot of debate. We talked about it before. And this is just a continuation of that story a bit. And that is that a new study has come out regarding so the Beckman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard has come out with a study talking about whether – with all the landscape of government surveillance and the landscape of technology around, whether it's getting harder for the police to actually get the data they need to get or if it's getting easier. And it looks like because of the widespread device explosion, the study concludes that don't panic. It's not going dark. It's actually getting easier for law enforcement to find data about people. So, for example, they mention, you know, toasters and bed sheets and light bulbs and cameras and toothbrushes and door locks and cars and watches and other wearables are all going online and they all have a footprint, right?
Well, a lot of them will have a combination of gyroscopes, accelerometers, magnetometers, proximity sensors, microphones, speakers, barometers, infrared sensors, fingerprint readers, radio frequency antenna. I mean, all these different things.
Actually, I think all those things are on our phones.
Yes.
But
they may show up in other things. They may show up in some appliance to know how much shimmy there's, vibration is going on, to know when it needs to be serviced or,
right.
you know, what the temperature is like inside the refrigerator.
We didn't even mention the televisions with the cameras on the face of them, right? So there is a myriad of other devices going on in the world. And so the study basically talks about, well, even though some of these technologies are being locked down and hardened and the police argue, no, it's going dark, it completely, you know, it's missing the major change in our culture, which is much more sensors and a lot less security in general.
I don't know about a lot less security. I think in terms of when the web was new.
Yeah.
There were a lot of security vulnerabilities that came up, not because it was less security, but because the avenues for breaking into a system or compromising a system, like many of them weren't even theorized.
Yeah.
Like they weren't possible. They weren't even on the horizon. And then suddenly you have these confluence of different technologies coming together and you go, oh, wait, but now this is possible. Oh, when someone has their little lapel pin that's checking to see how far they're walking, which has a gyroscope, an accelerometer, and a magnetometer to know like direction, how fast you're going, and what your angle is. If you hack into that, you know where anyone is at any given time inside of a room. Like that's and that's just not something we ever worried about before because we thought, well, if you have an infrared camera outside, maybe you can see people. But if they have good insulation on the house, you can't really tell.
But you can now.
But you can now.
You really can. And so the Harvard study is funded by Hewlett-Packard. And it's unusual because it involves technical experts and civil libertarians and officials who are or have been on the forefront of counterterrorism. So they know their stuff. Larry Kramer, the former dean of Stanford Law School, who heads the foundation, noted it Friday that that until now, the police debate has been impeded by gaps in trust, chasms, really, between academia, civil society, the private sector, and the intelligence community. And so in case that's Larry Kramer said that, who's funding the study or running the study. Anyway, the study is titled Don't Panic, Making Progress on the Going Dark Debate. And it really just brings out the counterpoints about this debate and how we actually the police probably have more ability now to detect and fight crime, or at least detect the communications and all the different ways of picking up knowledge about crime. So there, I think that's a good counterpoint. And we know. Miles and I will be right back, so please keep listening here on GeekSpeak. You're listening to GeekSpeak on Independent Public Radio KOSP. I'm Lyle Trox. With me in the air room is Miles Elam, and we're chatting about lots of geeky stuff. You can join the conversation anytime you'd like. You can send us you can get us on Twitter or on Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks, and of course, we're also online at geekspeak.org, and you can email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. So, in fact, yeah. So, Miles, you no longer work at Google, and when you did work at Google as a software engineer, not software programmer, right?
At least that was my job title.
We didn't talk a lot about what you did because, of course, one of the things about working for a tech corporation is you got to play by the rules of your employer. And
although, in fairness, I did not have necessarily a lot of access to things that would cause much damage.
Right, right. It's not like okay. So while you were there, you were a front-end engineer, UI engineer, just like I am now.
Well, and some back-end, yeah.
And some back-end.
I was around,
all over the place, yeah. And the service you worked on was like the Maps service, right? I mean, you did
local search, yeah.
Local search. So when you go into Google Maps or Google in general and you search for like
Google
a local
search,
restaurant.
Not Maps.
Not
if
maps,
you're going
okay.
into search and you search for a local restaurant or if you said food near me, that would be the local search team.
Kind of like the Yelp stuff. Kind of like
yes.
Yelp. Okay. And then there'd be like a little widget that would show you at a restaurant. You could click on it. You get more information. It'd have a map. You could actually review
see
it.
The, see
all
the
that
photos.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
So find out the open hours.
There's a little bit of richness in that app space. You worked on it for a while, but there's a little bit of there's depth there.
Oh,
it's
quite
a complicated
a bit,
application.
Yes.
Yeah.
And more so than what seems so on the surface.
Yeah, I would agree that almost always the applications that are done well seem simple and are quite complicated under the covers. So while you were there, can you give me an example of one thing that you put out in the wild or something simple that we could talk about as an example of improving the system?
I'm trying to think now of things that I worked on that were not superseded by some other code because there was a lot of code churn, like a lot of stuff. Code that you wrote might get replaced again very soon after.
Especially
in the front. Pretty much, yeah. It's constantly building upon itself.
Who decides? Okay. So when you're going to change an application like that that's used by millions and millions of people every day and all the time, how is the decision made to what features go into it and what gets changed? Let's do an example of this. You have
Now you're getting into processes that I'm not as comfortable talking about.
I'm not talking about that. I'm actually about our topic in general, which is A/B testing.
Sure.
That we're talking about this idea that, like you say, your code might have been superseded by somebody else, who then was you had superseded somebody else. Like it's being overwritten and changed all the time, which means the functionality is changing. What's driving the change of the functionality? Like why is it happening?
Well, one person may have it starts with some person having an idea,
okay,
saying that, hey, this seems like a good idea. And then the people that they report to go like, hey, that sounds like a good idea.
Let's say a good idea. Like, we have to have some kind of good idea. How about a link to the menu on their website?
Well, here's one.
Okay. I'm trying to think of some – I want to tie this down to reality here for a second so people can really understand what we're talking about.
If you were to look for – this is the last thing I worked on when I was there. If you were to look for a restaurant that recently moved or closed.
Okay. Restaurants close and move. That's
right.
Totally true. Right?
And it was launched originally with saying – it was just saying this restaurant is closed. And when you're dealing with that much data, you're going to have errors creep in. There's going to be some problems. The issue with Google is that its scale and its scope is so vast – that if we say, hey, this place is closed.
It's kind of closed.
It's a major problem because someone's going to search for it and go like, oh, it's closed. What happened? Yeah.
Right. And so maybe like three people ended up reporting that it was closed. What really was meant, it was not open this weekend. They reported it's closed. And if that propagated through the system, all of a sudden that restaurant, no one would go there anymore if they were finding it from Google. So it's a problem. Okay.
Yes. And
So someone came up with the idea with, we should probably handle this better.
Right. So one thing they did was, you know, they launched it and they see, did people like the UI and on there? And then it got rolled back going, okay, we've seen some problems. We have too high a false positive rate.
Okay.
And that's saying like when we had it before and what we have now and what are we seeing as the result. Now, that is a very backwards looking at seeing what the general network effects are.
Effect, yeah.
As opposed to right off the bat saying, okay, how does it look? Does it just have the business there? And even if it's closed, we just still show the business? Do we have it with a bright red line? Do we have the text just be red with the white background? How
you mean some way to say to someone to inform a person that there's a that this is probably closed, but not to block the data in case it's a mistake. Like that's kind of the goal.
Well,
there.
That was something else adding in there was being able to go in and say, hey, this is not actually closed, and then have it go in and have it reviewed.
Okay. So so when this is launched,
but more to do with like the look of it as well. Like how do you present this information to people so that it is useful to them.
Sure.
Which is the motto for Google at the time.
How do you decide whether the change you made of making the red title text red, how do you know that that's a good idea or that that is the best way to do it?
You have a few different ways. With regard to a user interface change like that, many times you will pay people to come use your system, someone who doesn't know anything about the system involved. Mm-hmm. Many times not a technical person.
And then ask them.
And then say, use the system, do a certain set of tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't coach them. You just say, you watch and see what they
go
did.
Go find a restaurant that has burgers under $4 in this area.
Right.
You come and have like 10 people do that, and you look at them doing it, and you kind of take metrics and see how long it took them. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you do it again with some more people with a different color UI
exactly.
And see if it gets better. So that's actually user that's user case studies, right?
Mm-hmm. That's one level. Mm-hmm. Of comparing between different ones, and so especially if you're looking to see if it works better than what's already there.
Yeah. So last week I traveled for my work, and we went and did user studies where we, you know, watch people use the application and ask them what they're thinking and doing, what they're thinking about when they do things. So we watch them do something, and then we say, "Hey, why'd you click on that instead of this?" And they kind of give feedback. So that's the story-based ways of possibly improving the system. Mm-hmm. And we learned some information from the people that we checked. We checked like 18 people on something. But that's not Google scale, right? That's just small asking people what they think. Is that
right.
Useful?
Well, you have to do that at some point because you need to have humans involved to know if you're on the right track, especially for a major visual change. Although with this one, a lot of the review had happened long before I got there. With a relatively minor design change. What you'll also do is you'll put it up, and this would be something like, for example, when I had pushed for SVG to be tested, vector graphics.
Scalable vector graphics is a type of data format that is visual to information. Most images, GIFs, and JPEGs you might have heard of are actually bitmaps, meaning that they have a big blob of data, and this pixel's on, this pixel's off, and this pixel's on. And that's the actual data of the file.
Yeah, this pixel's SVG, red, this pixel's green, this pixel's white.
And SVG, a scalable vector graphics, means it's an algorithm, a mathematical algorithm that creates the drawing, which is cool because it's infinitely scalable, which is nice.
Yeah, it says.
So you were.
Yeah, it says. You have a green line going from this point to this point.
Right.
And so you don't have to keep track of all the pixels in between. You just say from here to there.
Draw it.
Yeah.
So like how game systems draw on a computer screen. So you were using SVG or you want to use SVG in maps? So this is a bigger change.
Yes, in general. Google wasn't using them.
Yeah.
And I was curious as to why, especially because there was constantly a push for how do we make things smaller? Because if you make it smaller, generally it's going to take less time to download. It's going to display faster. And
with the explosion of mobile devices with multiple pixel densities, you had image problems. Like an image that you want to show on an iPhone 6 Plus, like my phone, mm-hmm. you actually have to have more pixel density to show a comparable image than an iPhone 4, for example.
Right.
So there's different size images having to be created and delivered on the wire.
Right. So it seemed kind of a no-brainer to me. I was like, okay, well, I worked with some folks who were already there for a while. This was soon after I got there. I was like, okay, let's... can we do a study? And so some other folks set up a study. I didn't know how to do studies at that time. And we replaced the Google logo with an SVG one on mobile devices, just trying it out. And
For like a small group of people that you watched use it, or larger?
The study would usually captures, say, like 1% of traffic.
Okay, so that's a very different thing than the study we're talking about where you watch people use the application.
Right.
You're talking about doing an A-B test where you live launch a change. And when you're saying 1% of mobile traffic of Google, you're talking about billions of views a day.
Yes.
Okay. So you basically changed the logo to an SVG logo, and then you deployed it to a billion people without them knowing that they were getting something different than the rest of the people.
And visually, they shouldn't have seen a difference.
They shouldn't have seen a difference, right. But the question wasn't not whether it was designed differently, because it should look the same, but whether the performance was comparable or better. Mm-hmm. And so what you'd assume is that if it was a smaller – if it was a less impact on the computer and the network, then people would get served their search results faster and they'd get served quicker, and therefore they'd have an improved experience.
Mm-hmm.
That was the theory, if you will.
Yes.
So this is an A-B test. That's what it's called in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I learned about it a few years ago. Now, of course, that's my primary role is writing A-B tests at Netflix. That's what I do, is create the software changes, and then we test them. So you were testing like 1% of the Google population on a little change
that
idea
that
you had.
That hit those particular types of searches a particular client. Yeah.
Right, mobile devices,
that. Yeah, it's still – I mean, of local searches. Yeah. I mean,
so for that one, did it work? Was SVG a win?
And so what happened was – it wasn't. Looked at click-through rates.
Right, because if it was a win, we'd actually have that. After that, it would have just gone
well,
out.
There is more SVG now, actually. But at the time, when I was – this was 2013, there were quite a lot of devices that just didn't handle SVG very well.
Android devices that weren't updated,
And even some of the older iOS devices. Yeah.
Okay.
So what happened was, yes, the image would get downloaded faster.
But they wouldn't see it.
But it would with regard to like a JPEG or a PNG, what would happen is as soon as it started downloading the picture, the image, it would start to paint it. We've seen it before. If you have a large image and it starts to paint from the top and you're watching it draw down below and then you hit refresh and it's there immediately.
Mine's in the news group days and early dial-up modems. Yeah.
Right. So with a PNG – you can start doing that, and it can start rendering as the file is coming in and stream it in.
Because actually the image, this pixel data, starts in the upper left-hand corner and goes across and goes down the next line and so on. But when it's a mathematical formula, until you have the whole thing, you can't run it.
And with SVG, the last thing that comes in an SVG file is the thing that's on top.
Oh, right.
The first thing's on the bottom,
right?
And then the next thing goes on top of that, and the next thing goes on top of that.
Because it's like an HTML document. The later things get on top.
It's like if everything were absolutely positioned, and you didn't change the order.
So what you saw was less people were actually seeing the full image.
Well, people were seeing the full image because this was just the logo. Once they got it, it was usually cached. But it still – once it was cached, it then became how long does it take for the system to render? And PNGs have been optimized to the nth degree in browsers.
Right.
SVGs, not so much. So the SVG took longer to render on the system.
Right.
And even though the file size was 1/10 size.
Yeah, very cool. So that was a failure, not because of a detail of implementation at the client level, that without seeing it in the wild like that, you wouldn't know how many people were affected. Because, of course, if I opened it on my iPhone and your iPhone, it would have rendered really quickly. The SVG pipeline for iOS devices is pretty fast.
Right. And at the time, devices that had a high pixel density were still so-so. Like they were kind of getting there, kind
of
2x.
So it wasn't enough
of a
need, really.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I found around the time that I was leaving that people were putting SVG more into play, especially because on mobile devices you were finding that the star that you now have to have at 2 or 3 times the dimensions, and an image that's 3 times the dimensions is actually 9 times as big.
Right.
Because you're going in both dimensions 3 times in both height and width.
Yeah.
Then you started seeing those numbers start to shift in the other direction.
Yeah. So since then, since that 2013 time when Google decided not to do SVG as their logo for mobile, you think that things have changed a bit?
Well, using the logo was just a quick, easy way to find a common theme that
right.
we would always
sure,
hit
sure,
it.
Sure.
Yeah.
So do you think it's moved over to SVG now? Like, do you think maps are SVG at this point? It's interesting because it's kind of hard to know one outside of Google.
See, there's one I can't – I'll just leave it at maps is already a vector.
Uh-huh.
It's actually a mixture and it's not SVG.
Oh, interesting. Is it – okay. Well, cool. Maybe – yeah. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about A-B tests. I find them fascinating. When I first heard about them, I was doing a panel and I was interviewing – developer, a manager at Facebook, Netflix, eBay, PayPal at the time. They were the same company. I think they're not the same company now, but they operate differently anyway. And all these people were talking about A-B tests, and meaning that unbeknownst to the customer base, people that are actually using this stuff, the software developers are constantly running tests to find out what's successful or not. Mm-hmm. Instead of going into a debate about, no, I think this color is better or this color is better, or no, I think a great example is at Netflix, we have on televisions the pictures for a title that you're going to pick are landscape, right? They're wider than they are mm-hmm. tall. On an iPhone, they're taller than they are wide. They're called portrait pictures, right? Mm-hmm. So in looking at that and playing with that, we investigated moving it landscape on the phone, and so far we haven't seen it be successful as portrait on the phone, right? Mm-hmm. An interesting example, because like, how would you know which is better, right? I personally love the look of landscape imagery because it matches that the show is, right? It's a 16:9 picture. Yeah. It's more like the show.
And you'd really be surprised how often what seems – absolutely obvious or intuitive ends up being completely wrong.
That's right. Yeah. And the other thing that's neat about this is that it's the nuance. It's, you know, it's kind of like AI in the sense that, in like a neural nets, where you don't really know why it's not working as well as it could or why it is working as well as it could. So you play with the connections, right? You mm-hmm. change things slightly. Like, is the reason why the box art on an iPhone have to be portrait is because of how close they're together or because, you know, other qualities about it? Mm-hmm. Maybe just on a TV, it's so weird to have everybody, maybe everybody likes portraits, but to have a portrait thing on a TV is so jarring that that's the problem, right? It mm-hmm. has nothing to do with the actual implementations. It might just be that what the user expects is causing it. And that could vary over time. Right, so there's a lot of complexity involved, and the thing that's neat about the way of testing is instead of going this is how it should be and asking a lot of people and maybe looking to psychology about image mm-hmm. acceptance, you just put it out there and try it. And the way we do it is these A/B tests as well. We normally, when we're going to make a change, maybe have 6 or 7 different cells, if you will, mm-hmm. and those cells mean a different experience. And then we'll put maybe 10,000 people in each of those, and then we'll look at their user experience over 3 months. Now, of course, these cells are not. They're not a bad experience, right? Our designers and our UI engineers are all involved in them. Mm-hmm. We're all happy with each of those experiences. Yeah. And some of us are kind of going, I think this one's going to win. I think this one's going to win. And over a period of time, you kind of see sometimes it's flat, meaning it doesn't really matter. And then we kind of go with the one we think looks best. But sometimes it really matters. So like it affects people's willingness to keep staying on the surface.
What really gets you is when you have a difference of about 10, 15 milliseconds. And you go, 10, 15 milliseconds, what does that matter? I don't mean in terms of like, oh, we're going to add more and more over time and it's going to add up to 3 seconds. I mean just that 10 or 15 milliseconds. For example, if you have testing on a scale of Google or Facebook, what does 10 or 15 milliseconds matter? We'll talk about it in a little bit.
You're listening to Geek Speak here on KOSP. I'm Lyle and that's Miles. We'll be back in just a second, talking a little bit more about A/B testings at Netflix and Google, I guess, since that's our expertise. All right. Stay with us, won't you? You're listening to Geek Speak here on KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the air room is Miles Elam. We're talking about A/B testing, a pattern of software development where you just deploy your best guess and see what people like and use. And you were saying that besides the design of something, the look of something, there's also the potential of it being faster or slower. And you said 10 or 15 milliseconds. Can you tell me how fast that actually is, Miles?
If something is a second, it's pretty easy for us to see. Something's half a second, you can perceive it. In fact, you can perceive pretty easily down to a quarter of a second, and then people start to break down. They're not quite as good. At 100 milliseconds,
that's a tenth of a second.
Yes, it basically looks instantaneous to us, mm-hmm. to the human brain. When some action happens, it looks like, whoa, that
it couldn't be faster.
Right.
Right.
So if you can get something on a web page in about 100 milliseconds. It's great. I mean, from the user point of view, there is no delay.
Oh, meaning
there.
When you do like a Google search and you search for like bananas and you see results within 100 milliseconds.
Yeah, you hit the G key and suddenly the results for what you were searching for come up and you're kind of amazed going, wait a second, did it come up before I hit the G or not?
Yeah.
When you're looking at the results of that, And what you test is how likely someone is going to click through to the a link, going to click on an ad, stuff like that.
The general theory of Google's of success for Google, I'm assuming, is how quickly the people find what they're looking for, if you will.
Or whether or not they click through to find what they're looking
for. Right. So like if they do a search and they look on the page and they don't do anything, that's kind of a failure. If they do a search and then they click on something and it takes them somewhere and then they don't go back to Google for a while, you can assume that they're successful in finding what they find.
It gets complex. Because if someone's looking for the phone number to it and they type in the restaurant and the phone number's on the page, then they don't click on anything. That's actually a good thing.
But yeah, that's it's a more whole, complex, obviously. Yeah. But in general, that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
The success.
10 or 15 milliseconds, like for myself, I can't see that.
No,
like,
no, I don't think I can.
Two things happened, and one was 10 or 15 milliseconds before the other one.
Well, that's a difference of like a 100th of a second, right? I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
It's really fast. Okay. So what you're saying is that when you actually do the test and you slow something down by that much, 10 to 15 milliseconds,
yes,
the brain of the engineer goes, well, that's not going to matter. But then you actually look at the study with millions of people using it.
Right. And it does make a difference. It makes a measurable difference.
The difference between something that's unperceivable still has a difference?
Yes.
That doesn't make any sense.
Even though human beings couldn't possibly see the difference—
it makes a difference.
You still see the drop, the slight drop, but the drop.
Because we're talking about millions of people. And so that average of insignificance actually has significance, even if each person consciously doesn't perceive it.
Right.
That's amazing. You're saying 10 to 15 milliseconds actually matters?
Oh, yeah. When you're talking about that scale, if you are an individual, you know, small business, I don't know if that matters as much because usually someone's going to you because they're looking for
– because they already spent an extra 15 milliseconds on Google and you were the result, so obviously you're good.
But when you're at that scale
and
you need to get those results back, you start really seeing dissatisfaction with your users.
So speed really matters. We know this in web development. It's been a kind of a standard for a long time, but it matters quite a bit. And actually, that's one of the big debates about advertising, because the advertising system we currently have for online ads is such that it's extremely hard to make that fast. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen kind of a bloat in web development where the ad system just adds seconds and seconds of time, which of course we know is horrendous.
Yes. Especially when those ads are blocking the rendering of the rest of the page. When the ads just take a little bit longer to load up, but the rest of the page isn't blocked, not really a problem.
Right.
But those times where, I'm sure you've seen them before, where the page doesn't show until the ads show.
Yeah.
Until you get back. And those ad agencies may take 2 or 3 seconds to get back to you.
Luckily, because of the press this has gotten, this is getting better. We're seeing it quite an improvement.
But I mean, like 2 or 3 seconds after the 2 or 3 seconds it took for you to give the page back originally, you really see that drop off. Like after, actually, the numbers have probably dropped quite a bit, but the, say, 5 years ago, if you took longer than 8 seconds, people just left.
Right.
They're just like, oh, the server's not working. I'm going to go someplace else.
Yeah. Don't you think that's still the case?
I think it's a lower amount of time now.
Yeah.
I think people are more impatient. It changed a bit because on the mobile devices, people were expecting it to be a little slower.
Mm-hmm.
On desktops, they were expecting it to be faster. But even now, the mobile devices are getting much, much faster.
Yeah.
And so if you're waiting more than a couple of seconds, people will start getting annoyed.
So the reason I want to bring up A/B tests is we hear about them in the news sometimes when they're kind of creepy and kind of weird, like they're social change. A great example of this is I think we talked a while ago about Facebook doing a test where Android devices just crashed.
Right. It was that whole we're going to try something that thing that they were trying caused a crash, and then they were all able to see what resulted from that.
Yeah, exactly.
Collateral damage.
Right. And of course, taking yourself out of that test means the crash didn't happen anymore. That's probably how the story got populated. But there's other examples of this is where we've heard studies where Facebook will potentially show more sad posts to people. So the friends feeds on Facebook are let's say 150 people or so. You're not going to see everything everybody posts. But what Facebook can do is curate what you see, how much you see of what. And every
and they do aggressively.
And they do aggressively. Their goal to do that is to make you stay on the service more and for other people to stay on the service more. So the more that they can get you to engage, the more the service is good to you, the more ads they show.
Which is why we also end up in echo chambers, because the things that we like the most and the things that we look at the most are the things that they are more likely to show us again because we've shown that we're interested in.
And there's definitely that problem. And the other aspect of this is if they want to do something like, go, okay, we're going to just – anybody's happy comments of your friends won't be seen today. All the sad comments of your friends will be seen today. That will change the way you post. And so this is a relatively easy for them thing to do, and they've tested this kind of thing. And to be clear, the reason I know about this is that they publish these results. Like Facebook is a major developer and shares a lot of knowledge about what kind of social tests they do. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating stuff. It's very important to understand that in all these companies that you – when you are online, whether it be on Facebook or Google or Netflix, as you're using the service, what you experience is not the same as everybody else's experience because of these tests. And lots of times, lots of them are run at the same time. So you might – at Google, when you're going as a user, you might see 50 or 60 different tests. And those tests are mostly going to be different from your neighbor. So everyone sees slight changes to all of these services. And I think that's interesting to understand that it used to be that if you go out in a mall, what you do at a mall and what I do at a mall and what we see is the same. But when you're online, you're not seeing the same as everybody else. You're seeing an average and a conglomeration of many things, which I think is an interesting thing to be aware of in our society. Additionally, if you don't like this idea of tests and participating in this and getting the service better and having it change and all that, you can – most of these companies will actually allow you to take yourself out of the tests. I don't recommend it because it's kind of cool to see the new things before they happen, but you can normally do that as well. All right, let's move on to other things. You had made a recommendation of what we cover next, Miles. Was it the Comcast story?
Yes. Let's talk about that.
Because we've got a couple Comcast stories, actually. Well, first is the FCC's plan. Was that the one you wanted to chat about? Okay. So the FCC, the Federal
Communications Commission,
Chairman Tom Wheeler dropped a major announcement, a bomb, a giant change just this week. Basically –
Another one, I should say, because when he talked about broadband being defined as 25 megabits or faster, up and 5 megabits upstream or faster, that was dropping a bomb.
But this one is major, and what he's basically saying is, hey, cable companies that have cable boxes that are proprietary, we want to open up that space. We want to make everybody be able to make a hardware cable box that can use your network. This is a comparable, Miles, you were saying it's comparable to another time when we saw this kind of thing.
Right, like in the 80s late 70s, very early 80s,
yeah.
Where I remember there being these, ivory, off-color, off-white phones.
Green as well, but yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. And you rented them from Ma Bell.
A traditional radio alarm phone. It's the phone that you see on the Monopoly board, right? It's that mm-hmm. standard receiver, curly cord, and a radial dial in the front.
You did not own your phone.
That's right.
You rented your phone.
That's right.
And you could not connect up another phone to that system.
And the reason – the general idea of that is that the phone system was the telco's – the Bell company's phone system, and therefore the device on it was theirs. Just like right now, cable company has a cable and their device is theirs.
Right. The line they were also using was, we don't know what those other phones will do to our network and we have to be careful. And then there was an antitrust suit and Ma Bell was broken up.
And part of that was anybody can make hardware as long as you do it like this.
Right. And suddenly you had all these different types of phones.
Yeah. And awesome phones.
Yeah. People were able to have like the see-through phone when you see the lights.
I was thinking of too. Right. I totally love that one.
You had
the princess phone. There's a ton of them that hit the market.
You had a lot more choices for the touch tone, or you could keep a rotary, or you could, get a designer old antique looking one.
So when you open up that space for everybody, you see innovation in that space. And that's actually why the FCC is recommending and kind of saying this is going to happen.
Now, or rather,
it's going to be contentious.
They had done it before with the cable card. There's a little card that goes in the cable card. And they were saying, yes. So as long as you make the hardware for this cable card, then you can put your own interface on top of the cable network and that should be okay. And then the cable
companies – And this was around 2000 era. Yeah. They made the cable card. And different companies were like, we're not going to do that. That's crazy. But a few of them did actually. TiVo is exactly
why. Well, actually,
a
lot of them did want to do that. The only problem was the cable company said, oh, well, we have to certify that and test to make sure it worked with it. And they dragged their feet, sandbagged quite a bit, so that it really wasn't worth it to any company to try to get through that that system. And one of the only survivors of that shakeout was TiVo.
Yeah. And what we're talking about here is that – so like the cable company, like Comcast, has a cable box that you rent from them. If you're watching TV, it's their box. I think maybe you can buy them too, but most of the time they're leased and they're part of the service. And they charge you for that. But what's important is the stuff that goes inside that box, they control completely. You'll sometimes see that TiVo is available in these boxes, and the reason for that is this product called the cable card, which is basically a way of you – it's an interface basically to allowing you to be the cable box provider. But Comcast and these cable companies never actually let go of the power, and that's why it wasn't really successful. That's why we don't see Apple and Microsoft and Google with cable boxes. And the FCC's ruling here, their judgment on this of saying this is going to be an open place, means technically if it goes through and it doesn't get killed in court, because we don't know, it would mean that Apple could produce a box that you plug into your cable, the only box you'd have. You'd plug it right in, and you'd be able to watch all the cable shows and then also do all the things that Apple wanted to do, and Google and whoever else as
The counter argument that the cable companies are giving is that they are already subject to a great deal of competition.
Sure.
From the Apple TVs and the Rokus.
And the iTunes.
And the Chromecasts.
And the Netflix services.
Right. Mm-hmm. Where they're getting all these streaming services coming in, you know, through the internet pipe, and people are bypassing, cutting the cord, as it were, with cable. At the same time, once again, flipping that argument,
sure,
you have also on your phone, you can look at, for example, where Comcast is in our area, the Xfinity app on the phone or on the tablet, but it's not available. I mean, even though it's available for iOS, it's not available for Apple TV. Even though it's available on the Android device, it's not available for streaming to a Chromecast.
Right. So what you're talking about is the cable company enters the app space by producing an app called the Xfinity app.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, you can stream video if you have certain pieces of hardware.
Right.
Apple's, for example, but not Apple TV.
Their notion is you can watch this stuff on the go.
Right. But when you're at home, you're using our cable box.
Yeah, you use the TV. It's not a replacement for a TV. It's
to compete with other on-the-go companies.
Right.
So, and you know, this proposal that Tom Wheeler, FCC, is recommending is like the best case scenario for Apple, Google, Samsung, Microsoft, all these hardware manufacturers that want to be in that space.
And in some respects, the cable companies as well, because the cable companies also have to maintain these boxes and they're getting the money for the rentals, but they also have to deal with the hardware problems with them. And to a large extent, those boxes don't have a lot of diversity compared to the rest of the tech industry. So you're kind of stuck with some of the models.
I agree. I mean, the innovation aspect is definitely one of the problems. I mean, the thing is, though, if you get an Xbox or a media center from Microsoft that has your cable modem in it, you are very connected to that brand and that connection and those services. You get an Apple TV, for example, that can also be your cable box. Well, now, anytime you're going to buy something, you're not going to do a pay-per-view for the cable company and they're going to get the revenue. You're going to get it through iTunes instead because it costs about the same amount of money and it's easier, and then you can also use it on your ecosystem, if you will. Mm-hmm. So the hardware connection the cable company has, losing that to other vendors is very damaging to the cable company. I think it's good for the consumer. I think it's good for these large tech companies that make hardware, but I don't think it's good for the cable companies. I think they're going to fight it tooth and nail.
Having used the Xfinity app with my parents have Comcast cable, and it's interesting because it is directly trying to compete with the Netflix space and the Amazon streaming and the like, in that you have all these shows that are on cable, but they're on demand. I want to watch something on NBC. Here you go. I want to watch something on CBS. Here you go.
Do they have ads?
They do.
Ugh.
Yeah.
I don't watch ads.
It actually depends upon the content. There are some things that I've watched that did not have any ads in them, and there were other things that had 3-minute long ad breaks in between 5 minutes of content. It was ridiculous. And I think that had to do with whoever the content provider was, less than the cable company itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, shall we move on to the second little story about FCC?
Sure.
This is just a cool hack, if you will. I think you're going to cover this, right, Miles?
Sure. Comcast has been known with their internet connection to be, shall we say, uneven in its service.
Less than stable in its speed and quality.
It's always advertised as up to 50 megabits a second, or up to 25 megabits a second, up to, you know, that type of thing. And so when it goes lower, slower than that, they're like, hey, we're not actually guaranteeing that.
Right. But you can call and complain at that point, right?
Right. Yeah. And every once in a blue moon, it actually makes a difference. But if enough people complain, then – but it's also an effort. It's an effort for someone to say like, well, is that – especially because Comcast can also point the finger and say, how do you know it's not your router that's causing that? How do you know it's not your hardware that's causing that? There's so many different variables that can go in there. How do you know it's not the remote site that you're trying to connect to? How do you know it's not, you know, the end streaming video company that is eating away at our business? That type of thing. And so this Comcast customer took a Raspberry Pi, the $35 computer, and hooked it up where it did a speed test every hour. And it just pinged going that speed test. And if the speed was below...
You mean it tested how fast the connection was every single hour?
Yes. Okay. And if that speed went below a certain threshold, what they were saying the advertised speed should be, it made a tweet saying,
a
here's what
tweet.
My speed is now on Comcast.
This is Alesky P. It's a Reddit user who actually wrote this little code and made it available in Pastebin. So you can, if you go get a Raspberry Pi, you can hook up this and run the same code if you want to harass your cable company for not doing what you're paying them to do. Hey, you're listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. And GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geek said hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org or email us. We're geeks at geekspeak.org. And of course, you can contact us on Twitter and Facebook and all those social places. We're at KOSP Geeks. I'm Lyle Troxell, and Miles Elam, thank you for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah. We might have time for one little follow-up story, if you got it.
Yes, we got one little quick tidbit, which is Apple is no longer the most valuable company in the world.
Which one got surpassed?
It is now Alphabet.
Google formal name, right? Yes.
Well, Google is now – Alphabet is supposed to be the company of companies.
That's right.
So Google is a company within Alphabet.
Awesome.
The umbrella company.
Thanks also to our intern Chandler, our Canadian correspondent Greg Merkley, Michael Newman, Pet Star Music for our theme song, and thank you for being here for episode 5 of our 16th season. See you next week and see you online.